and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a growing conflict between the executive and the legislative branch over subpoenas and oversight, and speak with a journalist and legal scholar who has found that the Constitution has no answers when it comes to solving this conflict. Noah Feldman, a columnist at Bloomberg and professor of law at Harvard Law School, who previously served as a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice David Souter, and is the author of The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President, and host of the new podcast Deep Background, joins us to discuss his article at Bloomberg, Trump and Barr versus Congress Can Only End in a Stalemate. We will look into how the framers provided no remedy for the struggle between Congress and the president over congressional subpoenas or specify Congress's right to investigate, nor did they define executive privilege in the Constitution. So, with an attorney general unlikely to act even if the House finds the Secretary of Treasury has broken the law, and uncertainty of how to enforce penalties of contempt on Trump officials who refuse to testify to House committees on orders from the president, we will assess whether the public will ever learn from the leads the Mueller report left for the Congress to investigate and what went on behind the scenes with Mueller and Barr. Then we'll try to understand why the press, which Trump vilifies, as he did again on Saturday night at a rally in Wisconsin, normalizes his outrageous behavior and dishonest statements in covering his rallies, where he calls Democrats murderers of babies, the press sick people, and FBI officials scum. Nevertheless, CBS described the rally with the headline, Trump energizes supporters in Wisconsin. USA Today's headline was, Trump takes swipes at media in rally during White House correspondents' dinner. And the AP headlines with, Trump cheers economy, criticizes Democrats at Wisconsin rally. Aaron Rupar, a journalist and the associate editor at Vox, where he has an article, Coverage of Trump's Latest Rally Shows How Major Media Outlets Normalize His Worst Excesses, joins us. And finally, we will speak with Chris Whipples, the author of the bestseller, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, about reports that the current acting Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, got his job by telling Trump he would let Trump be Trump and get rid of the guardrails on his presidency. This, Chris Whipple argues, is a recipe for disaster, making a dysfunctional presidency even more chaotic, in contrast to how James Baker made Reagan's presidency a success. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Noah Feldman, a journalist and professor of law at Harvard Law School, who specializes in constitutional studies. Previously, he served as a law clerk to Justice David Souter of the Supreme Court, and he's an opinion columnist for Bloomberg and the author of The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. And he's the host of the new podcast, Deep Background. And his latest article at Bloomberg is Trump and Barr versus Congress Can Only End in a Stalemate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Noah Feldman.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Noah, are we not going to see the House Sergeant-at-Arms arrest Steve Mnuchin and drag him out of the Treasury Department in handcuffs?
Well, I suppose there are people in the House Democratic leadership who might welcome the imagery, and probably a few people in the country, too. But no, that's not going to happen. And the reason is, first of all, that the Congress doesn't use its contempt power like that anymore, although they did a couple of hundred years ago. And the second is that there's no clear constitutional resolution of conflicts over access to testimony between the presidency and Congress.
So if they can't arrest obstinate members of the executive branch who are being instructed by the president not to cooperate, can they fine them?
They could. Traditionally, what Congress can do is it can declare contempt on its own. It hasn't done that in many, many years. It can revert to a federal statute which says that it's a crime to be in contempt of a congressional subpoena. and then they can ask federal prosecutors to bring charges. The reason that quite won't quite work in this instance is that it would be Trump's Department of Justice that would have to decide to bring those charges, and it's pretty clear that they wouldn't, since the president would have, in these circumstances, directed the officials not to come and testify. So those are the primary courses of option available, and beyond that, what there is just pressure and pressuring the administration by not doing things for them that they might otherwise want done.
Well, is that to say then that William Barr, that finally Trump has his Roy Cohn?
I think that's still unfair at this stage. I mean, anyone who's familiar with the historical legacy of Roy Cohn knows that it goes very deep into bags of dirty tricks. So far, what William Barr has done is entirely in front of the public eye. He issued a summary of the findings of the Mueller report, which was in certain respects, I think it's fair to say, at odds with what actually appeared in the Mueller report. But he did that knowing full well that the report would come out within a few weeks, as indeed it did, and that he could be publicly criticized for misrepresentation, as indeed he has been. So he's still pretty far from the tactics of Cohn, who, remember, was the right-hand man of McCarthy in the House Un-American Activities Committee investigation.
Sure, he was a pretty odious character, but the context of Trump saying "Where's my Roy Cohn?" was about loyalty, which he expected from Jeff Sessions and didn't feel he had. And I'm just questioning whether or not Trump has the kind of loyalty he wants in William Barr.
Well, he certainly has a attorney general who has been willing to, while still staying within a defensible account of the law, do what seems to serve the president's interests. But that is a big difference. You know, when Barr was up for confirmation, he said explicitly, in a very surprising statement to make before Congress, "I'm not at the beginning of my career, I'm at the end of my career, and I can say no to anybody, and I can do whatever I want, and I'm not going to be beholden to anybody." And that struck me as, you know, very accurate, and also meant that Trump was taking a bit of a risk. If he did anything that required Barr to stand up to him, Barr would do so. But on the other hand, Barr is also willing to do what he thinks is within the law to defend the president. So I think he has somebody who's on his side, but he also hasn't asked Barr, that we know of, to do anything that presses the boundary of legality. And I think if he did, my instinct is that Barr would probably say no.
So what is Barr doing now then? How does it factor in, or how does it stand in terms of what you just said, in terms of not threatening not to show up on Thursday before the House Judiciary Committee?
What Barr is doing right now is a game of, he's playing a negotiating game with the House. The House has said, "We would like you to come and testify," without issuing a subpoena. He has said, "In principle, I'm glad to come." Then the House said, "Well, we're not just going to do our usual ineffectual 5 minutes per member of the committee questioning. We'd like to have a staff member, a lawyer presumably, question you in an extended way for half an hour." Now, of course, that allows for follow-ups and trying to put the person in a difficult position. And it's not at all unprecedented. I mean, that is something that has happened in the history of congressional investigations, but it's relatively unusual. It's usually reserved for very high-stakes circumstances, and especially circumstances where the goal is to put the witness on the hot seat. And what Barr has said is, "I don't agree to that. This is a voluntary offer to show up, and I'm not coming." So he's in a negotiation, and presumably the odds are that they'll find some way to resolve this negotiation, maybe with something in between.
Well, it doesn't come down to the fact that the Congress people who can't help themselves in terms of being grandstanders get 5 minutes and usually ask whatever questions they want, not necessarily the best questions. And then the idea of having staff lawyers ask questions is that there are going to be a lot better questions and more focused. So it does seem that Barr is trying to dodge the tougher questions as opposed to the more political ones.
I think you're right that he is trying to do that, but it's also worth noting that he doesn't want to be put in the position of somebody who looks like he's being accused of something. You know, when counsel asks the questions, we sort of imagine Michael Corleone, you know, being questioned in the Godfather film by counsel, you know, someone who's doing a more prosecutorial and adversarial approach. And pretty clearly, nobody who appeared before Congress would want that. So you can sort of understand Barr's perspective. And yes, I think you're right. He wants to avoid a hard and sustained series of questions, presumably around his decisions contained in the Mueller report. It's also worth noting that, as you said, we just assume that the members of Congress can't be trusted not to grandstand. But maybe we should ask more of our elected representatives. You know, maybe if we think there are hard questions to ask Bill Barr, and I think there are, maybe we should expect our elected representatives to be able to ask those questions and not to grandstand for once in their lives.
And again, I'm speaking with Noah Feldman, who's a journalist and professor of law at Harvard Law School, who specialized in constitutional studies. Previously, he served as a law clerk to Justice David Souter of the Supreme Court, and he's an opinion columnist for Bloomberg and the author of The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. And he's the host of the new podcast, Deep Background, and his latest article at Bloomberg is Trump and Barr versus Congress Can Only End in a Stalemate. But isn't the broader canvas here, if you will, Noah, about public perceptions of the Mueller report and what's in it? And to that extent, Barr has been very helpful to the president, one in framing it as being essentially from the four-page memo, not a big deal, and the president's exonerated. He ran with that, in the, you know, dancing in the end zone, saying no collusion. And then the report comes out, and of course he presents the report in a press conference, again kind of framing it in a way that makes it sound less than it was. And now we're in a position where some of the more damaging stuff, where there's quite a lot of it, is sort of seeping out through the cracks, but it's not necessarily getting to the public in any coherent manner. And if you look at the optics and the way that Trump is basically trying to prevent any more damaging information coming out, and the Democrats are trying to find a way to get damaging information out, the only time the Dems have laid a glove on Trump recently was with Michael Cohen. And I'm sure they want to get more of that kind of stuff on the record. Is that really what this game is all about?
Well, there's a lot in what you've said, and I agree with a good part of it. I think it's important to focus for a second on what the Mueller report did and didn't in fact say, instead of just doing the horse race analysis. The report did say that there was not sufficient evidence to show that anyone in the Trump administration, including Trump, colluded with Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election. We have to be straightforward and honest about that. So that is expressly stated by Mueller, not enough evidence to show that. Then comes the trickier section, which is the question of whether the president may have obstructed justice in the aftermath when the investigation was going on, both in firing Jim Comey and then in attempting to fire Mueller himself. And there the report is a little less precisely or sharply written. Among other things, the report begins by saying, we won't say that the president has committed a crime even if we think he has, which is a very strange thing for the report to have said, but that's what it said. Then it goes on to say that there probably isn't enough evidence to show that Trump obstructed justice by firing Comey, but that there probably is enough evidence to show that Trump committed a crime in his various attempts to fire Mueller. Now, you know, that's a sufficiently nuanced message that it's not so simple to state it in a soundbite for the general public, and it's certainly the case that Barr has done a masterful job of summing things up in a way that makes it sound like the president is exonerated, even though the Mueller report expressly says we are not exonerating the president. So no question that Mueller has been at work on that, and no question that Trump owes him for that and is probably very, very happy that he's done it. I think the Democrats probably want to push Barr more actively on that, but if they wanted to find the kinds of criminal activity that Cohen implicated the president in, they need to look elsewhere. They can't look primarily to the report. You know, the only sections of the report they could really focus on are those sections about the attempted firing of Mueller, which I suppose they could ask Barr about, but Barr could reasonably respond, well, you know, I just made my conclusions based on the facts as Mueller laid them out, and I have no new facts beyond that. The other thing they could do is they could probably ask Barr himself about his own conclusions, because Barr concluded, even on the basis of the material that sounded like it said there was enough to find a crime, that there wasn't enough to go forward with any kind of criminal analysis or criminal charge. And they could question him about that, and I suppose he probably wants to avoid that.
But surely, whether they get Barr up there or Mueller up there, wouldn't the Congress want to know, at least the Democrats want to know, what went on in these negotiations? Because we know that Barr had the report for some time, and it's very unlikely that he only had the report, a few hours before he wrote his four-page summary. Since it's 448 pages, and with supporting documents.
I think it was more than that. Yeah, I think they've even said that it was several days, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. But still, there are all kinds of rumors swirling around that there were negotiations going on. Whether or not he wore Mueller down or not, we don't know, but I think...
We don't, and I suppose they would want to ask about that for sure. My guess is that Barr is sophisticated enough that whatever conversations occurred, he knew could be subsequently repeated by Mueller. And I suspect that he covered himself pretty carefully that way. Remember that Barr's statement was joined by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who supervised the Mueller investigation from the start, and who was, for a long time, a kind of hero among critics of the president for helping to protect Mueller. So Barr was clever enough to get Rosenstein on board, and whatever Rosenstein will have done will also have been very clean and above board to avoid subsequent criticism.
Right, but there was some dissent expressed by members of Mueller's investigative team early on. They felt that the report was being mischaracterized by Barr. So,
which I think it was. I mean, yeah. In retrospect, now that we know what was in the report, I think there was some mischaracterization there. I think it's hard to avoid that.
Sure. But is that to say that maybe Mueller will actually have some things to say that may be quite, you know, explosive?
I would be shocked if Mueller said anything beyond what appeared in his report. I really would. You know, Department of Justice guidelines do say that, and those do apply to Mueller under these circumstances, that you're not supposed to say anything beyond what's in a written document. And my guess is that he will be careful to follow that as closely as he can. So, of course, it's not impossible, but I think the odds are against an explosive revelation from any testimony by Mueller.
So in your first podcast of your new podcast series, Noah Feldman, Deep Background, you had Usha Rangappa, former counterintelligence agent with the FBI. I actually hosted Usha and Scott Horton at Columbia and Harper's and Malcolm Nance of MSNBC at a forum I did a couple of weeks ago at UCLA. And all of them were very pessimistic about what was happening and going on with Barr. They thought that maybe we wouldn't really learn anything, that maybe he could spark the whole thing, which clearly didn't happen. But one of the questions or one of the answers that came up that was interesting when I asked all three of them what would motivate Barr to cover up for this president, I think it was Scott Horton said that, well, you know, Barr is actually very close to Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, and they're both very conservative Catholics, and maybe they don't care so much about Trump, but they want all these judges on the courts, both at the federal bench and at the Supreme Court level. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, look, I don't know what's in Barr's mind. You know, I think there is some fantasy that when you were attorney general many, many years ago and you get called more or less out of semi-retirement to intervene in a situation where the country is, you know, in a crisis, it must be very appealing to think that you could come in, serve a president faithfully, and come out looking historically good. And that must have been something of the appeal for Barr. After all, many, many other people had no interest in taking this attorney general position at this moment. I have no doubt that Barr, like many other conservatives, thinks that the crucial aspect of the Trump presidency is for Trump to be able to choose appellate and Supreme Court judges and justices. And there's no question that the Federal Society has played a central role in the selection of a whole generation of young and, in many cases, extremely smart and qualified, very, very conservative people. So could that be part of the bigger calculus? I suppose so. What I think is really noteworthy is that the Trump administration and Trump himself could have chosen all sorts of very conservative, unqualified people for the courts and probably gotten a lot of them through the Senate, given their control of the Senate. Instead, the Trump administration has followed a strategy of outsourcing many of these choices to the Federal Society, with the result that they're getting some of the most intellectual, sophisticated, and yes, extraordinarily conservative young people onto the courts. Many people who are, you know, in my generational cohort, people who teach in law schools and people who I clerk with in many instances. And, you know, I have to say about just about all of them that I know of who've been nominated and mostly confirmed that they're very smart, that they're very well qualified, and that they're extraordinarily conservative.
So just to touch on Justice Souter, who you clerk for, Noah Feldman, He made one of the most prescient remarks several years back after he retired up in New Hampshire. I think it was on a local PBS station. And he said that his greatest concern about America and the direction it was heading in is that there's a growing lack of civic literacy, that we don't understand the Constitution and we don't understand and we don't teach civics anymore. And that he felt that because of this lack of civic literacy, that at some point or other, the American people would choose a kind of populist demagogue who would say, I will fix everything for you, and that they would sort of swallow the Kool-Aid. And most analysts have suggested that he was predicting a Donald Trump. Do you recall what I'm talking about?
Well, in the Federalist Papers themselves, Alexander Hamilton warns against direct election of the president and says that one of the dangers is the election of what they called in the 18th century celebrated persons, which is our word for celebrities. So a distrust of the capacity of the U.S. public to make the right decisions about who to elect for president is as old as the republic itself. Now, to be fair, not everyone has thought that in our history, and the process whereby the U.S. presidency went from being indirectly elected by the state houses of representatives to being chosen directly by the people is part of a process that happened elsewhere in the English-speaking world in the 19th century, where the countries went from being loosely democratic, or maybe only very slightly democratic, to being very democratic indeed, broadening the suffrage, allowing more and more people, and eventually women and African Americans, to vote, and then bringing on board direct election of senators, who also originally were chosen by state legislatures, and then ultimately of the presidency. So it's too late to reverse that process. It is worth noting that, you know, today, many of the people who are most critical of the public's election of Donald Trump are also people who see themselves as center of the left, or left of center, and therefore, in principle, ought to welcome the idea of the public making crucial political decisions. And, you know, that's an important question for people who see themselves as left of center. Do you believe in the people? And if you don't believe in the people, then what's so great about a democracy? I don't think it's the fact that one doesn't like the choice that the people have made in a particular instance, or, to be more precise, the choice that was made by the Electoral College, you know, under the influence of our particular system of popular election, because the majority of Americans, of course, voted for Hillary Clinton, but nevertheless, under our system, we got Donald Trump. You know, I think if you have to, more than one election would be required before one should reach the conclusion that we shouldn't trust the people. I'm not there yet.
Right, but you've just made a point that contradicts your point, and that is that he was elected by the Electoral College. And my understanding is that if there's a pathway for him in 2020, it may well be he'll have an even greater deficit in the popular vote than the 3 million.
Very possible.
And so that leads you to really question, where did that particular relic come from, and is it immovable?
That comes from our voting by states. You know, that comes from the winner-take-all at the state level, which, you know, as states develop very different populations, becomes more and more unfair. And, you know, the fact is that if New York and California, which are very, very populous states, are heavily Democratic, then many of the people who vote in those states, they count in the popular vote, but they don't, in practice, their votes don't count that much when it comes to choosing the president because, you know, they were unnecessary, as it were, to win a majority of the votes in those states and therefore to win their electoral college votes. So, you know, unless we were to change that, which would require a constitutional amendment, we're not very likely to see in the future, you know, a movement in the direction of expecting the person who wins the popular vote to win the presidency. That disparity exists, and it's probably going to continue to exist. And it wasn't just Donald Trump who won that way, but also George W. Bush won that way in the year 2000.
Right, but just in closing, the demographics that you just mentioned, where the blue states like California and New York, where you have a concentration of people's vote, but they are diluted by the Electoral College, whereas in the rural states, they're in effect empowered. My understanding is that trajectory we're on means that by about 2050, you'll have 70 Republican senators and about 30 Democratic senators, and that would mean that the Republicans will always control the Senate and therefore the judiciary. And
The Senate's another kettle of fish. I mean, the Senate is yet a separate problem. So at the 1787 Constitutional Convention and the long, hot summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, the big states, represented by people like James Madison, who was the principal draftsman, came in assuming and expecting that there would be proportional representation in both the House and the Senate. And the small states eventually simply staged a walkout. They walked out of the convention and stayed out for several days, saying, unless you give us equal representation in the Senate, that is to say disproportionate representation in the Senate, we are not going to join the Constitution. And gnashing his teeth, Madison realized he had no choice but to go along with it, and the big states conceded because they had no choice. So that was illegitimate, democratically speaking, when it happened, has remained so ever since. It's a gross deviation from the principle of one person, one vote. But the small states knew what they were doing, and they wrote into the Constitution that they could never lose their status, even by constitutional amendment, unless they themselves, the small states, agreed, which of course will never happen. So the upshot of that is they created an unamendable, effectively, constitutional amendment to protect exactly their overrepresentation. So we're stuck with that because of the hardball that they played in 1787.
Well, I'm very grateful for the conversation. I think I'm not left with the sense that our democracy is going to get better. It may be get less democratic, but I'm very grateful for the information.
Likewise. Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Noah Feldman, who's a journalist and professor of law at Harvard Law School, who specializes in constitutional studies. Previously, he served as a law clerk to Justice David Souter of the Supreme Court, and he's an opinion columnist for Bloomberg and the author of The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. And he's the host of the new podcast, Deep Background, and his latest article at Bloomberg is Trump and Barr versus Congress Can Only End in a Stalemate. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to understand why the press, which Trump vilifies, tries to normalize his outrageous behavior and dishonest statements. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aaron Ruper, who's a journalist and the associate editor at Vox, where he just wrote the article, Coverage of Trump's Latest Rallies Show How Major Media Outlets Normalize His Worst Excesses. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Ruper.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. In Green Bay on Saturday night, Trump held a rally. He told the White House not to attend, or the people at the White House not to attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So he was up against that, and he did put on a show of sorts. But it was, as you've reported, a pretty ugly affair. He accused the Democrats of supporting infanticide. He said that the Democrats support doctors who wrap the baby beautifully before they get together to determine whether or not they will execute the baby. And he called FBI and Department of Justice officials scum, the media as sick people, and he even went on to say that he was behind the idea of dumping undocumented immigrants in sanctuary cities. And quoting Trump, it was actually my sick idea. So that's just a little bit that you mentioned in your article. But why is it that the very media that he castigates and vilifies and calls the enemy of the people to some extent, normalize him in their coverage. They don't really talk about him as the liar in chief and as a person who has lowered the discourse to the gutter and is a complete disgrace and an international embarrassment.
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, I think it varies a little bit from outlet to outlet. And I think people like me who cover Trump regularly generally are a little bit better at this than others who only cover, you know, for instance, some of the local media that only covers a specific rally when he's in town, or, you know, outlets that don't cover every single Trump speech. And those are the ones that I cited as examples of bad coverage in my piece, although some of them were from very prominent outlets, including CBS and USA Today. And I think it's just sort of the mentality of, you know, what worked covering previous presidents still works for Trump, which is kind of doing a form of stenography and just passing along what he's saying without really making an attempt to fact check it. And, you know, when you do that, you play into Trump's hands because, you know, he's out there spreading a lot of misinformation and rearing a lot of different groups of people, as you alluded to in the intro. And so I think, you know, it's kind of this outmoded way of covering presidents where, you know, you kind of assume that they're telling the truth and you just sort of convey what they're trying to say and the points that they're trying to make without doing that extra step that's necessary in the Trump era, which is really going out of your way to fact check and to put things in context and to hold him accountable in that way. And so to me, I think people who cover him regularly, as I do, and you know, Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star is another one that comes to mind, who does this really well, putting his statements in context and fact-checking. But I think for a lot of other outlets, they're still trying to adapt to the new reality.
Well, let's face it, Aaron. The mainstream media gave Trump about $6 billion worth of free advertising, and there's no question that they helped elect him. So you would think there would be some sort of expiation going on. I know it's not the job of the media to take sides, but I think they have to redress mistakes that they've made in enabling this guy to get to the position that he's in, let alone enabling him to get away with some of the most appalling behavior. Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star that you mentioned, he and you have it in your article, he cites three examples of the very rally that we're talking about on Saturday night in Green Bay, Wisconsin. CBS's headline for that, describing it, was "Trump energizes supporters in Wisconsin for re-election bid. You took back your country." USA Today, "Trump takes swipe at media in rally during White House correspondents' dinner." The Associated Press, "Trump cheers economy, criticizes Democrats at Wisconsin rally." The Hill, "Trump rails against political elites on Washington media's big night." None of those described what happened at all, really.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think there's also a dilemma, you know, now that Trump is president. I get this a lot from people who interact with me online where, you know, there's kind of this pushback toward paying attention to Trump at all. And there's kind of this attitude out there among some people that we'd be better off ignoring him and kind of ignoring the fear of it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that he is the president at this point. And so, you know, what he says does matter. Now, for a lot of the stuff that he says in terms of calling the Mueller investigation a coup and things along those lines, calling former law enforcement leaders scum, you know, I don't really know how that translates into any set of policies at this point. But it is notable that, you know, for instance, Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, the state in which this rally occurred, was on the Sunday talk shows defending some of the most egregious comments that Trump made during the rally. So, you know, the political system isn't really holding Trump accountable or, you know, pushing back on him in any meaningful way. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there really hasn't been that sort of reckoning, broadly speaking, in terms of doing things different the second time around than major media outlets did the first time. But I do think that there are, you know, I think the Washington Post has done a pretty good job overall covering Trump. And I do think there are examples of outlets that have kind of adjusted the way they do things to use the word lie or to point out when Trump is pushing falsehoods. And I think the examples that Daniel Dale cited in his tweet, which I included in my article and kind of fleshed out with more context from those pieces beyond just the headlines themselves, those are all examples of outlets that I think are still kind of doing it wrong, where they're just conveying what Trump is saying without any sort of context or any sort of effort to fact check what he's saying. And when you do that, it ends up reading like a piece of Trump propaganda, because, you know, you're conveying all of these smears that he is, you know, pushing to his audience and that his audience is eating up, while not explaining that while he's calling the Mueller investigation a coup, it actually began when he fired, you know, of his own volition, the FBI director, which led to his handpicked deputy attorney general appointing Robert Mueller's special counsel. So those are the extra tidbits of information that I think are necessary to pass along to readers these days when covering Trump. And unfortunately, there's still some outlets that are trying to adjust to that.
And the Washington Post's fact checker is now saying that Trump has hit 10,000 lies as president. That was from Glenn Kessler. So he's definitely reached something of an extraordinary landmark there. But you mentioned a little while ago, Aaron, what he said before the coup, statements that he made before the National Rifle Association. And frankly, I found that more frightening than the rally in Wisconsin. One, he was with the guys with the guns. Remember, the NRA, they cast themselves as the good guys with the guns. And he was making a not-so-veiled threat that if you impeach me, I'm going to unleash the guys with the good guys with the guns. And he talked about this coup, imaginary coup against him, and how he was thwarted without even having to use the guns. And he came across, you know, like a third world despot, the complete tin pot dictator. I thought he was almost full on fascist, and I've never seen anything quite like it, particularly in an American president. But I didn't get the impression that, I mean, I heard a few other people make similar remarks, like Chris Matthews on MSNBC, but by and large, you know, it was like, oh, just another rally. But given the venue, the NRA, I thought there was a real sinister purpose to what Trump was saying.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's very concerning when we consider that we're heading into this re-election cycle. And, you know, one thing that I think about just about every day is, you know, the comment that Michael Cohen made at the end of his congressional testimony in February, where unprompted, you know, this guy who has worked with Trump for, you know, the better part over a decade, he's served as his personal lawyer, said that he's concerned that if Trump loses, he won't leave office willingly. And, you know, when you hear him out there giving a speech to the NRA talking about a coup, you know, it only kind of reinforces those worries. Not to mention, I think what you were kind of alluding to, that, you know, these are people who are heavily armed and in some cases mentally unstable. And Trump is out there suggesting, or actually directly saying, that Democrats have tried to take him out with a coup. And, you know, by any definition of the word coup, the Mueller investigation was not that. I mean, like I said, it was brought on by Trump's actions as president, firing then FBI Director James Comey amid an active investigation of his own campaign. So he really has no one to blame but himself. But, you know, beyond the obvious concerns about radicalizing people who are heavily armed, to me, it kind of suggests that, you know, we could really be in for a big struggle in terms of, you know, the normal processes of a changeover of power if Trump loses. I mean, I think we can all imagine a scenario where he declares the election rigged and, you know, tries somehow to take that fight to the Supreme Court, or, you know, and I don't know what sort of avenues he would have to do something like that. But, you know, we're kind of overall in an unprecedented situation. And with that sort of overheated rhetoric, you know, I think it's definitely something that we can't dismiss as a concern heading into the 2020 election cycle.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Aaron Ruper, given that you're critical of the New York Times for describing Trump's rally on Saturday night in Wisconsin, where he talked about the Democrats murdering babies, their coverage said that Trump was reviving an inaccurate refrain.
Right.
And what I find sort of strange is that the Trump people believe that the New York Times and the Washington Post are the liberal media, and that they print lies, and the only people who tell the truth are Rupert Murdoch's Fox News. So that's the problem we have in fact-free America today. So I'm wondering why it is that the people who the Trumpsters think are the liberal elite spreading lies are so polite. I mean, what's the point?
I think part of it, honestly, and we sometimes, you know, have similar discussions at Vox, which is a progressive outlet, but, you know, not to the extent of a, you know, Think Progress or something that's even further left. But, you know, the word lie, I think, to a lot of people conveys a sense of mental intentionality. You know, lying is, it's not like just making a false claim. When you say someone is lying, it has that additional suggestion that they're doing so intentionally. But I certainly think when you hear Trump out there saying that Democrats support infanticide, I don't really, you know, if the word lie means anything, then that should be a lie, because clearly, you know, there's no evidence that that's a, you know, there's no Democratic politician who is out there pushing that sort of proposal. And so to me, it seems like a very clear cut case of Trump trying to demonize his political opponents by making false claims that he's doing so for a reason. And to me, that's kind of the epitome of lying. But I think, you know, when you read the New York Times fact check, and like you said, they use a very tortured formulation. I think it's, you know, reviving in an accurate refrain or something like that is the way that they put it. The reason I think from a journalistic standpoint that outlets kind of err on the side of caution is because they don't want to make suggestions about someone's motives that they couldn't prove. But I think, again, you know, we kind of have to toss that playbook out dealing with Trump, because I don't think we've ever had a president in American history who has lied as brazenly and as regularly as Trump does. And so, you know, the Times ultimately looks kind of silly when they, you know, contort themselves into a pretzel to try and, you know, be fair to Trump when, like you mentioned, you know, every time there's an opportunity for him to take a shot at the New York Times, he does it. So there is kind of an asymmetry there that certainly works in Trump's favor.
Well, Aaron Rupa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Rupa, who's a journalist and the associate editor at Vox, where he just wrote the article, "Coverage of Trump's Latest Rally Shows How Major Media Outlets Normalize His Worst Excesses." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the current acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, got his job by telling Trump he would let Trump be Trump and get rid of the guardrails on his presidency. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth, behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents. He's a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes and ABC's Primetime, and he's the writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Whipple.
Good to be back.
Well, thanks, Chris. And what do you make of reports now that Mick Mulvaney, the current acting chief of staff, and of course a lot of actings in the Trump administration, and Trump himself said he likes actings. He doesn't want to have to go through the confirmation process. But acting chief of staff Mulvaney apparently got the job because he told Trump that he wanted Trump to be Trump and that he'd remove the guardrails. So,
well, if it's true, then is anyone surprised? Because that's exactly the way Mulvaney has been performing as White House chief. You know, Donald Trump has drawn all the wrong conclusions from his first two and a half years in office. He seems to think that if everybody would just get out of his way, that brilliant decision-making would ensue. And we've seen how that's worked out. But it's clear that Mulvaney has decided to let Trump be Trump. And, you know, as I point out in my book, the gatekeepers, that's just a prescription for disaster. History shows it.
Well, what kind of a disaster do you expect? I mean, so far it seems like the wrecking crew is running amok, but a lot of people are concerned about the nuclear button, for example, the ultimate power of the presidency. If you follow the NRA speech that he made the other night at the NRA, it was quite frightening in the way that he sort of was all sort of third world tin pot dictator talking about imaginary coups and getting rid of his enemies, and the idea that he's talking about impeachment being thwarted and that the guys with the guns, the good guys with the guns that he was talking to, are almost like a weapon that he has in his back pocket.
You know, we've been hearing this for a long time, and we've been seeing more and more unhinged behavior by the president. And, you know, we should never normalize it or get used to it. And I think that, but you don't have to be worried about the nuclear button to be concerned about just whether this guy can govern. And I think the biggest problem, my overarching complaint about this White House from the beginning, if you just look at the way it works, it doesn't work. It's a broken, dysfunctional White House. And one of the reasons for that is because John Kelly for a long time and now Mick Mulvaney have essentially enabled his worst partisan instincts. You know, Trump still has not learned that there's a difference between campaigning, which is dividing and demonizing, and governing, which is putting together coalitions and getting stuff done. It's a chief of staff's job to help him figure that out. And Mulvaney hasn't done it.
Well, it is serious, though, when he goes sort of full-on despot. And that is where I wonder. I mean, I find it so ironic, Chris Whipple, that we're talking on a day when we learn that the FBI just broke up a plot to blow up people at the Santa Monica Pier. And this is the same FBI just yesterday or the day before yesterday in a speech at Green Bay, Wisconsin, Trump referred to as scum.
Yeah. Now, you know, there's no question about it. And the only thing you can really hope for in a situation like this is for somebody, namely a chief of staff in most cases, who can walk into the Oval Office, close the door behind him, and tell the president what he doesn't want to hear, namely that you're president of the United States, you can't go around trashing the rule of law and constitutional norms and the FBI. That way lies disaster.
So in letting Trump be Trump, and some of his apologists think it's wonderful, like Chris Ruddy, the CEO of Newsmax, a longtime friend, he's quoted by CNN saying that he gives the president his space and lets him shine as he protects his back. And as far as I can tell, he's pushing the envelope in a way that most presidents have never done. I mean, he's pushing the envelope in terms of not accepting subpoenas from the House, not accepting oversight. Who's suggesting there's any restraints on him? But I guess the real issue is, the problem is that there aren't any restraints. And to some extent, I suppose, by pushing the envelope and being so out of the mainstream in terms of our presidents, that gives him a certain amount of leverage, doesn't it? It's the sort of madman,
you know,
theory, isn't it?
What I would say to the Chris Ruddies of this world who think that it's such a great idea to just let Trump be Trump, think about Ronald Reagan for a minute. I mean, Reagan was a guy who, unlike Jimmy Carter, who was so much smarter on paper, Reagan intuited something Carter never realized, which is that, you know, he needed a James A. Baker III, somebody to help him to govern. Now, what was Baker famous for? Baker, among other things, was famous for facing down all the people who just wanted to let Reagan be Reagan. Baker was the hated pragmatist. He was the guy who wasn't going to let Reagan be true to himself. And the exact opposite was true. You know, without Jim Baker, there would have been no Reagan Revolution. Reagan never would have figured out how to govern. So even to people who want Trump to succeed, I would say take a look at Reagan and Baker, and now look at Trump and Mulvaney, and I think you'll see the difference.
So I guess then when you hear from the Club for Growth people like Grover Norquist, and the other character, of course, is the person that Trump has nominated for the Fed, Stephen Moore, since they're the ones famous for the mantra, you want to make government so small that you could drown it in the bathtub. So is that the idea? You're suggesting that without the James Bakers around, this chaotic presidency won't get anything done. But maybe people like Grover Norquist don't want anything to get done. And Reagan himself said that government itself is the problem.
Well, you know, to quote the immortal George H.W. Bush, Grover who? I just think that Grover Norquist has no idea how to govern. And I would certainly choose Baker or Leon Panetta, who, without whom, Bill Clinton would have been probably a one-term president. These were guys who really knew how to govern. And I think that's the test, whether you're Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Ronald Reagan. At the end of the day, it's about governing. It's about getting things done. Now, you know, people who oppose everything Trump stands for may not want that to happen, in which case I would recommend a chief of staff who lets Trump be Trump, because Trump has no idea what he's doing. He needs help from someone who can do what Baker did for Reagan and what Panetta did for Clinton.
Well, apparently one of the keys to Mulvaney's success is that, unlike General Kelly, who tried to limit the influence and access of Jared Kushner and Trump's daughter, Ivanka, apparently Mulvaney has encouraged them, given them more access, given them greater responsibilities.
I actually don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that it really is a fool's errand to try to tell the president's family that they can't come and go. And of course, we those of us who are old enough can recall what happened to Jim Baker's successor as chief of staff under Reagan. That would be Don Regan, who until now has always had a lock on the title of worst chief of staff in history. Regan famously hung up the phone on Nancy Reagan and was gone about 10 days later. So I think that Mulvaney is probably just being smart and pragmatic to let Ivanka and Jared have free access. And I think that it was probably foolish of Kelly to try to keep them out.
Well, but Chris Whipple, the fact that Trump apparently in meetings, he always turns to Mulvaney for, you know, sort of Wikipedia type advice, since Trump knows so little about governing, and I think he knows so little about the world beyond real estate. Is Mulvaney that kind of an oracle? I mean,
no, I know, but what's needed here is not an oracle. What you need is somebody, again, who can help Trump figure out how to govern. And that means that you're not just constantly dividing and disrupting. You're making compromises. You're trying to get things done. I mean, I think Mulvaney showed where he was coming from when he, number one, encouraged, evidently, according to the reporting, he encouraged Trump to go ahead with the government shutdown over the border wall. He also encourage Trump to try to repeal Obamacare again without having anything in its place, which would, you know, immediately strip 20 million people of their health care. Politically suicidal, just stupid on every level. And yet, evidently, Mulvaney was behind that. Now, that's what I mean by someone who reinforces the president's worst partisan instincts. And that's what a chief of staff is supposed to avoid.
So at the end of the day then, Chris Whipple, are you suggesting that let's keep this wrecking crew in place. They're not going to press the nuclear button, but they're going to make this dysfunctional presidency even more dysfunctional. I'm just curious to know whether that is less damaging or not.
I mean, well, look, you know, Mueller came back with a result that probably a lot of Trump's opponents were not happy about. But he has laid out a roadmap for congressional committees if they want to pursue impeachment, a political solution as opposed to an indictment. I'm not recommending one course or the other, and I'm certainly not suggesting that you leave the wrecking crew, as you put it, where it is. I think, as you know from my book, what I think is that a president, no matter who he is, needs a chief of staff who can help him figure out how to govern. And Donald Trump, more than any predecessor, desperately needs somebody, a grown-up in the room, who can help him to do that. He's chosen to go exactly in the opposite direction because he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, which he is not.
Well, just in closing, let me give you an anecdote which I find so alarming, and it's the reason why the last adult, or the one that we thought was the most adult-like, if you will, that's the former Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. He quit along with Brett McGurk, who was in charge with our Syria policy, when Trump unilaterally was about to order the U.S. small military footprint of 2,000 soldiers out of Syria, just at the time when they were mopping up ISIS. And their main job was to work with the Kurds, who were doing all the fighting, to imprison the remaining family members and surviving ISIS members who came out of the rubble, who decided not to fight to the death. And these are extremely bad people, and we don't know exactly how culpable and complicit their family members are, but the Kurds are doing the processing and they're holding these people, and Trump was about to just pull the plug on the whole thing. And Mattis and McGurk simply couldn't believe the recklessness of it, the idea that you would allow all these ISIS people. And here's Trump crowing to the country about how he defeated ISIS, and he's about to let these people slip back into Europe and cause mayhem.
Well, and just as troubling and as startling was the fact that, I mean, it's rare enough for a defense secretary to resign the way Jim Mattis did, but it's unheard of for a secretary of defense, particularly of his stature, to renounce the president's worldview in almost every respect. You know, his lack of respect for NATO or for treaties, and all the rest. And that was, in my mind, even more troubling.
Well, you know, the Mueller report that you mentioned, even though they didn't indict him on the Russia issue, they certainly made a case that he might, well, there's definitely some complicity there, the extent to which we don't know. So, you know, the question arises, is he really working for us or working against us with the other side? So that question has not been answered, at least to my mind.
Well, you know, it's been answered, of course, as far as Mueller was concerned, but I would agree that there's more. It's not necessarily the end of the road.
Well, Chris Whipple, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Our Presidency, the first in-depth behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes and ABC News' Primetime. Chris Whipple is the writer and executive producer of The Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs area. On Showtime. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.